Coming up next on 94.7 WTVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Welcome to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, resistance radio, and as I like to say, persistence radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today we have an incredible show about courageous examination of ourselves, our communities, and about how to flourish against all odds. We're speaking with Tish Jennings, an internationally recognized leader in the fields of social and emotional learning and mindfulness in education. She's written a new book, The Trauma-Sensitive Classroom, on how to help students affected by chronic stress and adverse childhood experiences succeed in the classroom. And we talk with Frank Dukes, expert in conflict resolution. He's a mediator helping communities address complex public conflicts in ways that strengthen those communities when other forces are pushing them apart. He's a member of the design team for UVA's Memorial for Enslaved Laborers to be completed this fall. And Nancy, my friend, so dramatic today. How are you? Are you there?
I am here. I am told, Ellen, do you have the news show smell at your studio? I smell it over here in New York.
What do you mean?
The new show has a great, clean smell. What do you got?
Yes, the first show that we've done. We've done live shows, but this is the first show of the new year with
of the
guests.
New year, I should, yes.
Yeah, with guests in the studio, yes.
Yeah.
And speaking of the new year, may I begin by saying that we were so honored and thrilled to be included in last week's Seville Weekly, a feature story about podcasts.
I wish you would say something about that. You have yet to say it, though, right? I mean, you're going to say it now. I mean, the thing you just said is not it. Now you're
that is it. No, that was it. And now we can be done with that. But we were really, really happy about that.
It was very cool.
Yeah. And then breaking news last night, I do have to mention from the New York Times, for anyone who wasn't watching the news between, I don't know, like 9 p.m. and now, FBI had opened a counterintelligence investigation about whether Trump was secretly working on behalf of Russia against America's interest.
Yeah, you know, I know this is the whole thing is a huge deal, but this particular piece of news that the FBI was doing this, I thought they were. I didn't realize this was so revelatory. I thought this is part of, you know, how we got where we are is because of everything that, you know, that Trump has done, his, you know, allegiance, you know, at the convention with the Ukrainian platform and Manafort and the whole thing. I mean, I just thought, don't we know all this already? But apparently we truly didn't.
I think it's about the FBI opening an actual counterintelligence investigation, not just a national security inquiry. But, I mean, I think
the distinction.
Yeah. And the fact that they were actually, some of the reporting is saying, you know, that they were actually really had to question if they should do this. That's the part that I, as a layperson, don't understand. They wanted to be so, so careful. I mean,
right.
Why?
Yeah. I mean, if the evidence is there, just, I thought we were a nation of people, not kings and whatever. So, I mean, no matter who it is, if it was anyone else and they were doing all those things, you would act accordingly. I'm totally with you. I just don't get the not everyone, but certainly the people around him, just hands off. You know, he's the president. Treat him with respect while he maligns the rest of us. You know,
And you know, we probably have to mention the shutdown that we're in the record-breaking territory, the 22nd day, and you know, it's just amazing to me that the Coast Guard is telling their people to hold yard sales and maybe become a personal shopper.
Right.
To make up income.
Right.
I mean,
do some carpentry. I know.
Yeah.
He's got more undocumented immigrants coming across the border at Mar-a-Lago than we do at the southern border. This is so, it's so ridiculous. It's like a, that Seinfeld episode where George insists he's, if you remember, he insists he's, he has a house in the Hamptons, and he keeps lying about it to his in-laws, to, you know, to Susan's parents, until he literally has to drive them out there when there is no house out there, but he cannot admit that he's lying.
I have to say, the administration is like the Seinfeld show. It's about nothing. I mean, what he's doing, except for the harm, I should say. He's doing nothing positive. So without further ado, speaking of
something positive,
accentuating the positive, we have a fantastic show. Our first guest is Tish Jennings. She's an internationally recognized leader in the fields of social and emotional learning and mindfulness and education. She's a professor and researcher affiliated with the University of Virginia's Curry School of Education and Human Development and the university's Contemplative Sciences Center. She's been recognized for her character, including bold innovation, imagination, courage, authenticity, and heartfulness, and of course for her research. She's written a new book, The Trauma-Sensitive Classroom, Building Resilience with Compassionate Teaching. Welcome back to the show, Tish.
Hi, Ellen. It's great to be here.
So tell us, what inspired you to write this new book?
Well, I have a history of childhood trauma myself, and then I became a teacher. And over the course of this long career, I keep seeing situations where teachers and education systems lack an understanding of what trauma, how trauma impacts kids' behavior and learning, and also lack of understanding of how best to support them. And so this was a book I've been wanting to write for a very long time. My own personal story was that at age nine, well, right before I turned nine, my parents decided to separate, which was, I'm still not exactly sure that that's what was happening, because at that age, it's hard to know. But we were living in Ann Arbor, Michigan. My father was a professor at the University of Michigan. And my mother decided to move to Tucson, Arizona. And my father drove us across the country. My father was quite an unusual character. We had a 1957 Volkswagen microbus in 1957 in Detroit, in the Michigan, which was really unusual. But we drove this bus across the country. It was quite an adventure with my dad. We got to Tucson. We landed in this very barren, dry, kind of very, very different than Ann Arbor place. And my mother was living in a tiny little junky apartment building, and she dropped, he dropped us off with her. And then he drove back to Michigan. As soon as he arrived in Ann Arbor, he died suddenly of an aneurysm, leaving us in Tucson with our mother. And over the course of these years, I've really discovered that my mother had very serious mental health problems. And so between the time my father died and I turned 15, my mother's mental health deteriorated very rapidly. We moved every single year to a different school, to a different crappy apartment. My mother abused alcohol and drugs. She was incredibly abusive. And I went to five different schools in Tucson. Finally, she committed suicide when I was 15, and leaving me as the oldest of three girls. And so the shock of that, just having to cope with your whole world shattering to pieces over the course of about 6 years. The other thing that I think was interesting during that time is that that was between 1963 and 1970 or 69. And there was a lot of turmoil in the politics at that time. And living in Tucson, which was a very conservative place at the time, I felt like a fish out of water. I never felt like I fit there, and I never really knew my peers. And I had one experience in school that was incredibly traumatizing right after my dad died. I was in fourth grade. I was sitting in class, and the principal announced that Kennedy had been shot. And my whole class stood up and cheered. And as a child who had been raised with parents who are fond of Kennedy, and having just moved to this new place where I didn't know anybody, I was paralyzed with fear. I couldn't express my grief, not only for my father's death, but the death of this president. But I also didn't know who I was with. Who are these people? And so I felt like an alien for sure the whole time I lived in Tucson. And that made it even more difficult to try to make sense out of what was going on with me. Fortunately, when I was 17, I discovered Zen meditation. And what Zen meditation helped me do was recognize that my perception that the world had been, had some kind of stability was it was an illusion anyway, and that I was more able to feel safe without having everything permanent be fixed as it's supposed to be. Because in the Buddhist philosophy, you start to recognize that this is an illusion, this sense of stability, and that learning how to be okay with that sort of natural chaos of the world really helped me move forward in my life. So I wanted to help teachers help kids like me. And as I started working in education, I kept seeing teachers making mistakes. They didn't make them out of trying to harm children. They just didn't understand what kids needed and were actually making things worse. And I also, so there's two things that I saw that were happening that were problematic. One is kids who come into schools being exposed to trauma often react to situations in ways that don't make sense. And sometimes they interfere with what's going on in the school. It's because they've adapted to a different context. They're not, their behavior is adapted to trauma and stress, not to a classroom. And our classrooms, our educational systems tend to punish kids like that, which is absolutely the worst thing that you can do when a kid is having that experience, because it reinforces the trauma that they already are experiencing at home. The other thing that I see teachers doing is lowering expectations because they're afraid that kids with trauma are going to melt down or be re-traumatized. So instead of having them do something challenging, they'll give them a coloring book or something because they don't want to stress them. But that doesn't help those kids at all. So I wrote this book to not only help teachers understand what's going on with kids with trauma, what the perspective of the child is like from my own experience, but also from the experience of a lot of informants that I gathered information from, other people who have similar but different experiences than I do. And to give teachers some practical skills for ways to respond to these kinds of situations, but also to give them the understanding that in order to respond to these kids with wisdom and care and compassion, they need to take care of themselves, they need to manage their own emotional reactivity, and they need to be able to calm themselves down so they can respond in intelligent, thoughtful, compassionate ways rather than reactive, punitive ways.
When you were growing up in Arizona, Tish, did you? I'm so glad you ran into meditation as a salvation. I was just curious, though. Did you ever? Were there any instrumental teachers in that strange state that you felt comfortable with, or did it take till you took the started investigating meditation?
That's a really good question. Thank you. I had a high school teacher who was amazing. She was an English teacher who, at the time, they were starting sort of elective English. If you were a good English student, which I was, you could make choices about the kind of English you wanted to study, and she taught poetry. And creative writing really helped me as well to cope with how the strong feelings I was having, the pain of living through all that. And she had us keep a journal, and I wrote a lot about what was happening, and she would respond in the journal in a very nice, private way, but also with a lot of compassion. And she did make a huge difference in my life. And when I wrote my first book, Mindfulness for Teachers, I went back to try to find her, and she had already passed away, unfortunately, by the time. But I did find her niece and told her niece how important her aunt was to my development.
Can you tell us the types of trauma that you're talking about when you use that word? Is it always something really, really big? And also some of the behaviors that result in the classroom?
That's another really good question. I mean, trauma is in the eye of the experiencer. So what's traumatic to one person might not be to another person. And a lot of it varies by your own personality, your own history. But I'm talking about the range of things from, the death of a parent to a move. Sometimes just moving, even if the parents are not nothing goes wrong with the parents. They're still moving can be very traumatic for some kids. So one of the things I think is important when we talk about trauma in schools is that we need to consider that everybody in the school is either already trauma exposed or has the potential of being trauma exposed at any given time, including the staff. So that these practices and approaches need to be universal for everybody. The other reason why that's important is that teachers don't necessarily know when children have been exposed to trauma. A lot of that information is confidential. They just don't know. And so we have to create environments where everybody, including these kids, can function well. And other kinds of traumas can be, drug and alcohol abuse of parents. The opioid crisis is causing a huge disruption in children's lives today. The refugee issue is another traumatic situation. Kids coming over the border, I can't even imagine what's going on with those kids and how that's going to impact them over a long period of time. But even things like having parents that are constantly chronically arguing all the time.
So being that there are so many, of course, so many kinds of trauma, how does a teacher recognize that in a child's behavior?
Thank you for that question. So the behaviors tend to fall into two different kinds of categories. One of them, which was the way I coped with trauma, is dissociation, which is the tendency to space out or just check out. It's the freeze response in the fight or flight. It's also kind of a flight response. It's a disappearing tendency. So what I would do in schools is just make myself as invisible as possible. But I would also space out and not pay attention to what was going on at school. So things would happen where a teacher would ask me a question, and all of a sudden I wouldn't even know where I was, and I would look really stupid because I hadn't been tracking what was going on around me. The other reaction that kids can have is hyper-aggressiveness or hyper-reactivity. If they're living in an environment where they're experiencing threat a lot, they can imagine there's threat around them all the time, and they can be overreactive. So they can imagine people are doing something aggressive towards them when they're not. So they need some help learning how to calm themselves down. So when kids like that are in a classroom, they need space and time to calm themselves and de-escalate whatever's happening. But the tendency is, because teachers are always pressured for time, is to try to take the easy way out and just either exclude them or punish them immediately, or say, go sit down, or go to the principal's office, or whatever. And that actually is reinforcing that feeling of threat, because it's giving the message, I don't belong here. People don't care about me. People think I'm bad. And those are the things they're already grappling with.
Okay. Does the age that a child experiences trauma also? I know this answer, but I want someone smart to answer, affect its impact.
Yeah, this is a really good question. Age makes a big difference. And it varies a lot. There's different, depending on what's going on in the child's life, you can see a whole different variety of responses and behaviors. Younger children have a lot more difficulty making sense out of what's going on around them. Older kids can have the capacity to understand what's going on with them more, but they can also personalize what's happening to themselves even more. Like, it's my fault. Like, I must have done something wrong. That's a common response for older kids.
Well, I can't wait to come back after the break to talk more with Tish Jennings. She is the author of The Trauma-Sensitive Classroom. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Apropos of Something. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We're on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Tish Jennings, author of The Trauma-Sensitive Classroom, Building Resilience with Compassionate Teaching. So, Tish, you write about behaviors in the classroom perhaps being perceived as disruptive when they're actually being adaptive. They've been adaptive for that student. So is what you're saying also, since teachers might not be able to recognize that behavior, is to approach that, to approach every disruptive behavior with compassion?
Yes. Thank you. That's a great question. And yeah, that's really difficult. In our culture, we tend to approach disruption with punishment. That's just an automatic tendency in our culture. And so it really requires the adult in the equation to calm down and settle themselves so that they can make a response that's appropriate. Now, I'm not saying that we don't want to set limits and reinforce guidelines and boundaries with these kids. They need that. In fact, they need that to learn how to function in school. But you can do that in a way that's kind and compassionate. You don't have to do it in a way that's harsh or mean. And that, I find, is the tricky part. Because in our culture, there's a tendency to either be punitive and harsh and firm, or lax and passive and wishy-washy, you know. And so what these kids need is a combination of care and kindness and compassion, but also firmness and clarity, like clear expectations. They need to know what is expected of them. And they also need to understand that rules and expectations are for their own safety as well, not just for their, not just to impose on them, because they've had experiences often at home where rules and expectations are used arbitrarily to hurt them. And so learning that in school that's not the case can help them realize that the world isn't a dangerous place, and that there are people in the world that care about them and that they can connect with, because that's the thing they need most of all, is to find other humans, adults, children, that they can bond with and connect with and feel like they have value and that they have a role to play that can contribute to their community. That's the thing they need the most.
And since it's always, you know, it's always that relationship between the teacher and the student, what are the, when you take that step back to what do you tell teachers in terms of their own self-care, or, you know, getting their mind in the correct space to do all those things you've been talking about this morning?
Yeah, well, that brings me to my other book, Mindfulness for Teachers. So in order to be fully present to situations like that, it helps to not only have your own mindfulness practice so that you are building the capacity to be present in the moment with every situation like this, but also to take care of yourself. And being a teacher, especially today, is so challenging and so difficult and exhausting. And teachers aren't getting the kind of support they need. So in order for a teacher to make this transformation, they need to take care of themselves. They need to make sure that their own well-being is cared for, and practice activities that will help them stay centered and grounded and calm.
Yeah, this book does fit in with your other books. How did how does it fit in with your other books, the books you've written prior to this?
Well, the Mindfulness for Teachers is kind of a more general book. It's more about how we can apply mindful awareness practices to supporting teachers' practice in the classroom. And it's based on the research that I've been conducting for the last 10 years or so, supporting teachers with mindfulness-based practices. And we have found in our research that these practices improve teacher-student relationships and interactions and student engagement. So, and we did that research in New York City, by the way.
So can you give us some examples of mindfulness practices that we might use?
Well, one of them is really simple and basic. When you find yourself feeling a little bit of stress, or you start noticing that your body is getting tense, if you take 3 slow, deep, mindful breaths, it can totally shift your autonomic nervous system and help you calm down. It's important that these breaths be deep breaths and that you focus your attention on the sensation of the air going in and out of your body. So in that way, they're mindful breaths. You're bringing this present moment awareness to the experience of deep breathing. And that is a very simple way to calm yourself down. Another practice that we find very helpful for teachers is something called the body scan, which involves bringing awareness to every part of your body sequentially. And many teachers report to us that they do this before they go to bed at night, and it helps them sleep, because rumination about what's going on in their classrooms and things sometimes keep them awake. And putting your awareness in your body can help shift out of that rumination of the mind and get calm and ready to sleep.
Just to piggyback on that, on my own question, but when you're in the classroom in the middle of a lot of chaos that I know you've described before, what are the best things to do? I'm sure breathing is one of them.
Well, also teachers can model for their students how to do this practice. So, for example, when things get a little bit chaotic in the classroom, if a teacher starts noticing that she's feeling anxious or tense around what's happening, she can tell the students, I am feeling anxious, I'm feeling stressed, I can notice this because my shoulders are getting tense, I'm feeling hot, and I need to calm down because I can't teach when I feel like this. So I'm going to take 3 slow, deep breaths, and I want you to join me with this so we can all calm down together. And this, doing this, modeling this practice is one of the best ways to teach social emotional learning, because kids know when adults are upset. We can't hide that from them. And so if we could just be honest about it and then teach them what you do when you feel this way to make that shift, then it can make a big change in your classroom.
Are schools receptive to this approach, or is it teachers that are receptive? I realize it can be both.
I'm noticing that there's a big interest in this right now. It's growing very rapidly. We're doing a lot of work in the schools around here. I have colleagues doing this work in New York City and in many other locations all over the world, actually.
Well, including the Compassionate Schools Project, which is a huge study that you're involved with and helped write the curriculum for as well. There's been quite a lot of progress there, I know.
And that's in Louisville, Kentucky, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I realize the book is kind of new still. Do you foresee yourself going around the country to schools? How do you see ideally implementing this approach to classrooms?
I'm doing a lot of workshops and speaking around the book and helping people recognize the needs for this. I'm hopeful that schools are taking this seriously and are embarking on trying to transform their schools to support kids like this. So I hope my book adds to their library of approaches.
Really, a lot of the teachers that I come in contact with, either at work, where I work at the University of Virginia, or personal life, are just very, very hungry for this. They're always asking, and I get a lot of emails, because my work is related to yours a bit, at the university. They're always asking, when can we get this? When can we get our hands on this? So there is a big hunger for it. And do you think that curriculum will be available?
The plan is to make it available next fall. This is the Compassionate Schools Project curriculum, which is a social emotional learning curriculum that integrates mindfulness and yoga and healthy eating skills.
And of course, people should just buy your books
yes,
as well.
They should.
I mean, really.
Yeah. No. You had mentioned meditation for you was obviously really helpful. What role can meditation play in all of this for kids?
There's growing evidence that a simple, regular practice of focusing your attention on your breath every day for a certain period of time can change your emotion regulation. It can improve your ability to observe yourself and recognize when you're having a tendency to overreact. I think one of the reasons why mindfulness is really important today is that our autonomic nervous systems evolved to deal with physical threats in the African savanna, right? But today, the threats we experience are primarily psychological threats. They're not physical threats. And the autonomic nervous system isn't well adapted to psychological threats. And it creates behaviors and reactions that interfere with our social interactions. So mindfulness helps us. One way to think about it is it's like a biohack. It's a way of hacking this autonomic reactivity that we were that we inherited from our ancestors to allow us to be more thoughtful and calm and responsive rather than hyper-reactive to situations.
Well, it occurs to me that these practices can be used in every situation, parenting as well. Is there anything you would like to leave us with before you go that you haven't commented?
Yeah, I've been teaching a class called Mindfulness in Health and Human Development at UVA to undergraduates, and it's given me a lot of hope because there's a very strong desire among millennials and younger folks to learn these practices, and they recognize the value of them. And I see them transform before my eyes in these classes from these very hyper anxious, driven students addicted to their phones to calm, focused, present, wonderful, brilliant human beings. And the experience of watching this happen has given me so much hope for the future that I think that's what I'd like you to leave you with.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Thank you, Tish Jennings. And thanks for your new book, The Trauma-Sensitive Classroom. Thanks for being here.
Yeah. You're welcome. It's great to be here.
Hey, Nancy, do you have a news of note for us?
Hey, Ellen, I have a news of note for you. It's big and yet very small, and yet I'm predicting it won't surprise you, but it is news. In the Capitol right now, you know, you can't visit any of the Smithsonian museums. There's no federal staffers around to answer questions at the Lincoln Memorial. There's trash everywhere because of the shutdown. Yet, despite the shutdown, there is one landmark, one federal landmark that is unaffected by his inept deal-making and his limitless cruelty. It is the clock tower at his D.C. hotel, the famous hotel that he has there, which is staffed by National Park Service rangers. Mind you, it's a modest historic site. It's not the Lincoln Memorial. It's this modest historic site where the rangers often outnumber the visitors. And the administration has gone out of its way to keep the attraction in the federally owned building that houses his hotel running as usual. Meaning it has to be, that means it qualifies as a most essential service that it is unaffected. So with virtually everything else closed, but, you know, tourist-wise, this is where now many tourist operators are now taking their business there. And of course, it's increasing his business that any of this extra traffic is going there. It's just another example of his private interests overlapping with his holding public office. Mm. And there are watchdog groups that are adding this to the emoluments lawsuit, you know, and hopefully Congress, the new Congress, will check this out too. What do you got?
Just a new study co-authored by somebody at the Curry School of Education, Dewey Cornell, found that there's an increase in middle school bullying correlated with voter preference for the Republican Party. In 2017, 18% more middle school students reported they'd been bullied in communities around the state that voted for Republican Trump compared to those communities that favored Democrat Hillary Clinton. And then also, just to end on a little bit of a good note, as far as news of note, Virginians, about 200,000 Virginians got health insurance through Medicaid expansion last week, joining 32 other states who also expanded Medicaid. That's what I have.
Digging it. I'm going to exhale a big chunk of whatever. Carbon dioxide on that.
Okay.
That's great.
So our next guest, with no further ado, is Frank Dukes. He's a mediator and expert in conflict resolution, helping communities address complex public conflicts in ways that strengthen those communities. He served on the Charlottesville Blue Ribbon Commission on Race, Memorials, and Public Spaces that we remember from the past two summers. He's a member of the design team for UVA's Memorial for Enslaved Laborers, which is to be completed this fall. He's also the founder at the Institute for Environmental Negotiation and now a distinguished fellow there, and executive director of UCARE, which stands for University and Community Action for Racial Equity. And that addresses University of Virginia's legacy of slavery, segregation, and its impact on the wider community. He's done a lot more, and we can talk all about that in the interview. Welcome to the show, Frank Dukes.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here, Ellen and Nancy.
Yes, thanks. So you were called, I'll start this way. You won a Diversity, Equity, Inclusion Leadership Award and were called a moral compass by UVA Today's premier publication, UVA Today. How did you come to care as much as you do for this field of work that you do, mediating and repairing wounds, and specifically slavery?
I think you can go back... Actually, thinking of my own family. My own family raised with a very strong faith background, and also my mother's family. She's from Europe and was in an occupied country. And the idea that there are injustices and that you have to fight to overcome injustices is something that has been very strong impact for me. I think that idea of being called a moral compass is pretty hard to live up to. I think I've had a lot of moral compasses in my own life to be able to see. So being surrounded by people who love me and care for me, thinking of my own very much trauma-free background, that gave me the strength to be able to do some of the things that I'm able to do, and really working with on the coattails of a lot of people that have been coming before me, and also that are working to support the work that we're doing too.
Frank, I don't want to give you a long question because I know we're going to go to a break really soon, but what are some of the factors that contribute to your needing to be the mediator? What contributes to to public conflict?
That's a great question, because, of course, we need people that are advocates, and we value that quite a bit. I think, actually, I could say that mine came from the fact that I wasn't very good at handling conflict and recognized that and really wanted to get better at it. It was limiting the way that I was able to be in the world. I saw a lot of things that I wanted to help change, and so I actually started with community mediation. There's a community mediation center here, mostly to increase my own capacity for dealing with conflict, although I also recognize that there's a value for people. I mean, it's just fascinating, this idea that you can actually help people that are in conflict, divorcing couples, communities that are fighting each other and don't have any forums for bring them together. So I was actually realizing that was working, but I also wasn't learning enough, and learned that there was a graduate program at George Mason University, went there, finished the master's program, and they started a doctoral program right when I left, when I was about to leave, and I thought, I still need to learn more. So went through that. So it's a combination of learning, studying, researching, but also really following a lot of people. I was really lucky to be able to work at the Institute where I continue to work now when I was doing my graduate work, and being able to see some really good people being effective at helping bring people together to deal with conflict, to deal with the real elements of conflict, that as opposed to sometimes that we tend to deflect conflicts and fight over other things as opposed to the real substantive issues.
Well, we're going to get right back to that after this break. We'll be right back. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Stay tuned. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're speaking with Frank Dukes about conflict resolution. And before the break, you were talking about the real elements of conflict. Can you continue on with what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think sometimes we see people fighting over personality. They because it's so hard actually to really grasp some of the core elements of conflict. So the idea is that actually mediators are not anti-conflict. Without conflict, there's no change. But it's this idea that we need actually to figure out what are the real issues, what are the substantive issues that really need to be understood, that we then can surface. Oftentimes they're not surfaced, and then be able to actually talk through them and address them, if possible. Not all conflicts can be resolved. Not all conflicts are subject to conversation and deliberation, right? They're questions of justice, that need a determination. But so much of the fighting that happens actually is not over the issues that are really at stake. We do a lot of work on the environment, and so a conflict may involve a lot of litigation over who actually has standing, as opposed to actually getting the parties together and say, what's the problem here? What are the things that we actually need to be able to do? What's going to help this community? What's going to help actually bring about the types of solutions that are going to improve the quality of life for the people that we have?
Can you just illuminate some of the work, the actual work you're doing, either the coal fields? I know you're involved with that in Appalachia. We also want to hear about the Truth Commission. And
sure.
Just give us some examples of the work that you're interested in.
Sure. I'll start with Appalachia, and I think it's probably a good example of that. So we began work about 10 years ago in Southwest Virginia, in large part because of the concern about the mountaintop mining and the fighting that was going on over mountaintop mining, and not so much mediating. In the process of mountaintop mining is where the tops of mountains are blasted. So it's a form of surface mining that actually has enormous impacts, enormous environmental impacts, but also cultural impacts. But also in these communities, the fact is that they often have no other basis for the economy that they have. And so they see no other choices. So our work was actually about would people be interested in having conversations about broadening the economic base? And then they would be able to make choices, and perhaps choices that don't involve blasting off the tops of the mountains. And we go in there not saying we think that you're wrong for, you know, doing mountaintop mining. That wasn't the approach at all. But coming into the communities and approaching people and saying, we think that we can help you have conversations about your future together. Do you think that would be something helpful? Are there things that you're not talking about that you really need to be talking about? So economic issues, educational issues, the biggest exporter, obviously there's coal export, but a lot of people say our biggest export is our people, our youth. And so if you want to keep your youth, how do you bring people together? So we began what became a project called the Clinch River Valley Initiative. As I said, we started talking to people about 10 years ago. And actually, we worked about a year and a half before we had our first meeting. And the idea was not that we decided we were going to have this Clinch River Valley Initiative, but that we would have a series of conversations. And that's what emerged for people out of that. The people in the region said, we've got this Clinch River. It's a global resource. We think that we can actually use it. Not only can we help protect that river better, but we can actually use it to develop our economy, to improve our health outcomes. And so that was how we began that. And that's actually, I just stopped my involvement with that, along with a colleague, Christine Gauvet, a few months ago, but it's still going strong. There's a steering committee that's working on that, and they're doing great work down there.
When you work on what you call a collaborative change project, does it always start out that way, or do you ever get called to make it something that brings everyone to the table?
Sure, we sometimes get asked, and that's probably what most of our work is. There, where people are saying, "There's a problem here. Do you think you might be able to help us with that?" But we're also, you know, we're at a university, we're a public service element, and there's some issues such as the one in Southwest Virginia where people aren't paying attention to them, or they don't think that there's any way that you can actually bring people together to talk about them. So it's a mix of work that we do. Sometimes we get asked by agencies or localities to help them bring people together, and other times we see that there's an issue that people aren't paying attention that is causing some harm, and that the way that we operate would be to go into a community and ask, is what we do, this idea that we can help people talk with each other, is that going to be something that's going to be helpful for you in dealing with those issues?
So I don't want to overlook what's been going on here in Charlottesville and your work with the Blue Ribbon Commission and the Truth Commission. So can you describe the conflict that and your role in that? What transpired about the statues from your perspective?
Sure. So that's a pretty big issue. And I think I probably need to begin with UCARE, which is the University and Community Action for Racial Equity, and which is this idea, again, 10 years ago, that we have a legacy of harm. We have a legacy of white supremacy that has impacted this community. We have it at the university, but it impacts the community too. And how is it that we can begin to pay attention to that in ways that are actually going to be useful, in ways that actually we start to learn about that impact and start to be able to address that impact. And so I think the monuments and memorials are one example. They're sort of the visual representation that we've seen, the visual landscape. There's landscapes of slavery that have never really been altered, landscapes of white supremacy. And so the statues themselves then have more symbolic meaning for that. We actually had a class that several years before the commission came up that actually we did a little dialogue around the future of those statues. And so when the commission was a result really of advocacy, so obviously Ziana Bryant, the high school student, and Counselor Wes Bellamy and other people, actually Counselor Kristen Sakos was a counselor at the time, Kristen Sakos had been advocating for that. And I think the city decided to do a pretty smart thing, which was not just to make a decision, but let's see if we can actually engage people in that. And I was not hired. I was not contracted. I was actually along with everybody else, just a member, as a community member, a member of that commission. So I was not facilitating that. But I think in large part, we did a lot of the type of work that we do. We had three large community-wide meetings. Two of them had small group facilitation. So trying to bring people together to talk about the meaning of those statues and what we needed to do about them.
And then I know the Truth Commission is separate. So what is the mission of the commission?
So the Truth Commission is actually in the planning stage, and your listeners probably have heard of other Truth Commissions. I think perhaps South Africa would be the best-known example of that. But there are many dozens, actually, of others around the world, including some in our own community or in the United States as well. And the idea that there's been a harm and that harm continued, a past harm, which has ongoing implications, and how do we actually pay attention to that? How do we understand that history, but how do we understand that in ways that allow people to tell stories and to actually act on the harms that have been done? This latest effort emerged out of the pilgrimage that was organized by Jelaine Schmidt from Black Lives Matter and also a University of Virginia professor, and Andrea Douglas from the African American Heritage Center, out of a recommendation from the Blue Ribbon Commission on Race, Memorials, and Public Spaces. One of those recommendations was to participate in the lynching memorial that's being hosted in Montgomery, Alabama. And so that's an incredible story in itself, and I know we're not focused on that for this session. But coming out of that week-long trip and that journey where we had 95 people from Charlottesville, not only went to Montgomery, Alabama to deposit the soil of John Henry James, the man who had been lynched, but also visiting various sites of civil rights on the way and on the way back, that a number of people, particularly people that do public history, though we had people from Monticello and the University of Virginia, public historians and others, and saying that we need to do something to represent our landscape here in a different way. So it actually, we began with people that had been on that trip, and it's still very early in the planning stage, but the idea would be that we would have a Central Virginia Truth Commission, and we have about 25 people now that are starting to plan that, and the idea would be, again, that we would model this on what other communities have done at telling more complete histories, understanding the impacts today of these histories, and then actually addressing. So looking at what harms have been done, how do we repair them? Can we have a conversation about what constitutes repair? Can we have a conversation about reparations? What sort of actions actually would make us the community that most of us want to be? We know we're a broken community in many ways. We know we're not a whole community in many ways. What would it look like if we were a whole community, and how do we do that?
Would it be safe to say that, with all of these things that have been going on that we do know about, you are really behind the scenes in a lot of ways we don't know about? All this work is happening.
I think there are a lot of people that are doing a lot of work.
Yes, you and your people.
Yeah, I think there's quite a few people, and people don't, even some of the sort of mainstream institutions like Montpelier, James Madison's Montpelier, Monticello, of course, Highland, they're actually looking at their histories. They've reached out to their descendant community. University of Virginia, of course, doing that with the memorial to enslaved laborers you've talked about. But there are a lot of other people that are doing related work now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I want you to touch on what you know about UVA's memorial for enslaved laborers. Tell us about that.
Sure. I'm pretty excited about that. And that actually emerged as a student project, which is one of the reasons I'm excited about that. Starting about 9 years ago, some of the students that were starting to learn the history at the University of Virginia, when I was a student there, long time ago, I graduated in 1975, the narrative was that there were no slaves because Jefferson forbade the students from bringing their quote-unquote servants on the ground. And so I just kind of accepted that. And it wasn't until a student about 11 years ago actually wrote a undergraduate thesis and realized that not only were there slaves, but in fact, we were entirely a landscape of slavery. There were substantial numbers of enslaved people here, and the research has shown about 5,000 enslaved people actually worked on the university grounds during construction and then after construction up to the end of the Civil War. So the student said, we have to tell this story. It needs to be told, but not just on its own terms, but also for us to understand how that legacy of slavery still continues to play itself out. So, and I do remember talking to one student in particular, Ishraga El-Tahir, who became the first chair of the group that she founded. It was called MEL, Memorial to Enslaved Laborers, that maybe in her fifth reunion, and she graduated in 2011, that the university would have approved, you know, that by then if we're fortunate. And that, of course, for a student, that's like, that is impossibly long time. But the university actually, after a lot of effort and by a lot of people and more than students too, the Board of Visitors finally approved that in 2016. They put out a request for proposals for designers, and I think it was really brilliant the way they did this, as opposed to doing a design competition, just having people sort of imposing a design. They picked a design team that I was very happy to be part of. I'm not a designer, but our design team said that we want to go into the community. We want to talk to some of the descendants. We want to talk to the students. We want to talk to alumni. We want to talk to African-American alumni and ask them not what this should look like, but what should this be? What does it represent? What stories does it need to tell? What's it supposed to evoke in people? And so it was actually a process that took a full year of meeting and numbers of meetings. And I can get into more detail if you want, but just say we were in African-American churches and at the Jefferson School and up in Washington, D.C., talking to alumni and at the university and surveys and so forth, and then coming up with the design that the Board of Visitors approved. And the idea is that this is actually something that's going to not only tell the sort of the harms of slavery, but also recognize that these people had incredible, they had lives outside of their status as enslaved people. Of course, they crafted the beautiful, beautiful university, but they also had families, they had faith, and part of it is to provide a window, an entry into people wanting to understand more about the history that took place.
And it will be unveiled, do you know when?
So the construction's actually starting, and if you go by the university, you'll see a large swath of land that's actually enclosed by a fence right now across from the corner, and you can't get in. And the idea with assuming that weather and everything is going to cooperate, and they're still raising funds, but the idea would be that it would be dedicated sometime this fall. I don't know exactly when, perhaps October, but the idea is very much that we want to get it done this fall.
It would be great to get you back then to see what you're feeling about the end of the progress. Obviously, progress is already underway. It sounds amazing.
Obviously the construction and the view there, no one will ever be able to come to UVA again and say we didn't have enslaved people there. But I think the part that actually excites me more was the way that the community engaged in this, and that there are people that are descendants or other African American members of the community and others that are, you know, that are not African American too, that feel as though you really asked us what we wanted to have, and that we came back over and over again saying, well, what about this? What about this? And that this is something that they say, this is us. This is something that we helped create, and that we're part of this, and that the barriers that oftentimes the University of Virginia has set up have been lowered by that too. So and that's already happened. So I'm pretty excited about that. But I'd be glad to come back.
Terrific. We have a lot more to talk about, I think, with you and in more depth. Thank you, Frank Dukes, for being here so much, and also Tish Jennings, author of The Trauma Sensitive Classroom. Thank you both. So Nancy, what is it time for? The palate cleanser. We have just enough time.
And I'm going to breeze through. I'm going through.
Breeze.
Mine is, it's local, but it may be happening nationally for all I know. New York City Parks and the Department of Sanitation have created a new holiday tradition, which is ending this weekend. They recycle the city's Christmas trees. They put them in, because usually people put them in body bags on the curb. But now there's this thing called Mulch Fest. It lasts 10 days. As I said, it ends this weekend. And you bring your tree between certain hours to certain sites, and they will chip your tree up into wood chips in front of you so they can go nourish trees and make the city even greener. And if you're so fortunate as to have a backyard in New York City, you can even take home a bag of mulch. So they have recycled 25,000 trees.
Sorry to rush you, but I have someone standing over my shoulder today. Okay, so my palate cleanser is 3 days ago, for only the second time, astronomers have picked up a mysterious repeating radio signal called fast radio bursts coming from an unknown source in a galaxy 1.5 billion light years away. It is basically electromagnetic energy that's flashed, and it seems to be a big deal. So I just wanted to mention that crazy thing. And then that our music today is by Springtide, and we're going to be signing off now with some of that music. And I wanted to say that next week we're going to talk to a chef from Maya, also a very effervescent former monk who is really, really terrific person named Leslie Hubbard, and the chef is Gregory Lewis. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Nancy, so much.
Yep.
Yeah. And remember, everyone, no one has to do everything, but everyone needs to do something. So thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.